Chapter 24. There is no struggle too vast, no odds too overwhelming, for even should we fail, should we fall, we will know that we have lived. Anamanda Rake, Son of Darkness. The continent-sized fragments of the shattered moon sent reflected sunlight down upon the world. The fabric of night, closed so tight about the city of black coral, began at last to fray. The web that was this knotted manifestation of Kor-El Galain withered under the assault. Shafts broke through and moonlight painted buildings, domes, towers, walls, and the long-dead gardens they contained. Silvery glow seeped into the dark waters of the bay, sending creatures plunging to the inky blackness of the depths. New world, young world. So unexpected, so premature, this reign of death. Endest Silan could feel every breach as he knelt on the cold mosaic floor of the temple's grand vestry. He had once held the waters back from moon spawn. He had once, long, long ago, guided his lord to the fateful final encounter with Mother Dark herself. He had clasped the hand of a dying high priestess, sharing with her the bleak knowledge that nothing awaited her, nothing at all. He had stood, God, so long ago now, staring down at his blood-covered hands above the body of a sweet, gentle woman, Andarist's wife, while through the high window the flames of dying Karkanas flickered crimson and gold. The Selengara of the lost Karkanan forest lands had believed that the moon was Father Light's sweet seduction, innocent maiden gift to Mother Dark, to remind her of his love there in the sky of night. But then they had also believed the moon was but the backside of Father Light's baleful eye, and could one rise up and wing the vast distance to that moon, they would discover that it was but a lens, and to look through was to see other worlds for whom the moon was not the moon at all, but the sun. The Selengara tailspinner would grin then, and make odd motions with his hands.
"Perspective," he'd say. "You see? The world changes according to where you stand. So choose, my children, choose and choose again where you will make your stand."
"Where you will make your stand, the world changes. The world changes."
Yes, he had held back the sea. He had made moon spawn into a single held breath that had lasted months. But now, now his lord had asked him to hold back light itself, to save not a fortress but a city, not a single breath to hold but the breath of Kor-El Galain, an elder warren. But he was old, and he did not know. He did not know. Standing 20 paces away, in a niche of the wall, the high priestess watched. Seeing him struggle, seeing him call upon whatever reserves he had left, seeing him slowly, inexorably fail. And she could do nothing. Light besieged dark in the sky overhead, a god in love with dying besieged a child of redemption, and would use that child's innocence to usurp this weakened island of Kor-El Galain, to claim for itself the very throne of darkness.
"For she has turned away."
Against all this, a lone, ancient, broken warlock. It was not fair. Time was the enemy, but then, she told herself with wry bitterness, time was always the enemy. Endest Silan could not drive back every breach. She had begun to feel the damage being wrought upon night, upon the Tist-Andi in this city. It arrived like a sickness, a failing of internal balances. She was weakening.
"We are all weakening."
An old, broken man. He was not enough, and they had all known, everyone except the one who mattered the most.
"Lord Rake, your faith blinded you. See him kneeling there. There, my lord, is your fatal error in judgment. And without him, without the power here and now to keep everything away, without that, your grand design will collapse into ruin, taking us with it. By the abyss, taking us all."
It seemed so obvious now. To stand in Rake's presence was to feel a vast, unassailable confidence, that he could gauge all things with such precision as to leave one in awe, in disbelief, and in wonder. The plans of the Son of Darkness never went awry. Hold to faith in him, and all shall settle into place. But how many plans worked out precisely because of our faith in him? How many times did people like Endest Silan and Spinok Durav, do things beyond their capability, simply to ensure that Rake's vision would prove true? And how many times can he ask that of them, of us? Anamanda Rake wasn't here. No, he was gone. Forever gone. Where then was that solid core of confidence which they might now grasp tight? In desperation, in pathetic need. You should never have left this to us, to him. The sickness in her soul was spreading, and when she succumbed, the last bulwark protecting every Tist Andi in black coral would give way. And they would all die, for they were the flesh of Kurald Galain. Our enemies feed on flesh. Lord Anamanda Rake, you have abandoned us. She stood in the niche as if it was a sarcophagus, fevered, watching Endest Silan slowly crumple there in the center of that proud, diffident mosaic spanning the floor. You failed us, and now we fail you. With a gasp of agony, Apsalara lunged backward along the beam. The skin of her hands and forearms had blackened. She kicked in desperate need, pushing herself still farther from that swirling vortex of darkness, sliding on her back over the grease of sweat, bile, and blood. Steam rose from her arms. Her fingers were twisted like roots. The pain was so vast it was almost exquisite. She writhed, twisted in its grip, and then pitched down from the beam. Chains wrapped against the sodden wood. Her weight pulled them down in a rattle, and she heard something break. Thumping onto ash-smeared clay, staring as she held up her hands, seeing frost-rimed shackles and, beneath them, broken links. She had felt the wagon rocking its way back round. Horror and disbelief had filled her soul, and the need to do something had overwhelmed her, trampling all caution, trampling sanity itself. And now, lying on the cold, gritty mud, she thought to laugh. Free. Free with nowhere to run, with possibly dead hands, and what good was a thief with dead, rotting hands? She struggled to uncurl her fingers, watched the knuckles crack open like charred meat. Red fissures gaped, and, as she stared, she saw the first droplets of blood welling from them. Was that a good sign?
"Fire is life," she intoned. "Stone is flesh. Water is breath. Fire is life. Stone is water, is flesh, is breath, is life. Pluck a flower from a field, and it will not thrive. Take, and beauty dies, and that which one possesses becomes worthless. I am a thief. I take, but do not keep. All I gain, I cast away. I take your wealth only because you value it. I am Apsalara, mistress of thieves. Only you need fear me, you who lust to own."
She watched her fingers slowly straighten, watched flakes of skin lift and then fall away. She would survive this. Her hands had touched darkness and lived still, as if it mattered. Even here, beneath the wagon, the dread sounds of war surrounded her. Chaos closed in on all sides. Souls died in numbers beyond counting, and their cries revealed a loss so far past comprehension that she refused to contemplate it. The death of honorable souls, the immense sacrifice wasted. No, none of this bore thinking about. Apsalara rolled onto her side, and then onto her knees and elbows. She began crawling, and then gasped anew as a familiar voice filled her head.
"Mistress of thieves, take the eye of the god. Apsalara, steal the eye."
Trembling, wondering, how could he reach so into her mind? He could do so only if, Apsalara gasped a third time. And so, once in pain, once in wonder, and once
in hope.
She resumed crawling.
"Pluck your flower. I am coming for you. Oh, yes, I am coming for you.
With each soul consumed, the power of chaos grew. Hunger surged with renewed strength, and the beleaguered defenders fell back another step. But they were running out of steps. The indomitable legions surrounded the now stationary wagon and its dwindling ring of souls. The countless dead who had answered Hood's final summons were melting away, most of them too ancient to call upon memories of strength, to even remember that will alone held power. In standing against the enemy, they had done little more than marginally slow the advance of chaos, as all that remained of them was ripped apart, devoured. Some, however, were made of sterner things. The grey swords, delivered unto Hood by the loss of Fenner, fought with grim ferocity. Commanding them, Brucalion was like a deep-rooted standing stone, as if capable of willing himself immovable, unconquerable. He had, after all, done this before. The company fought and held for a time, an impressive length of time. But now their flanks were under assault, and there was nothing to do but retreat yet closer to the enormous wagon with its heap of bodies. A score of Segula, all that remained of the second's forces, formed one impossibly thin link with the grey swords. Each one had fallen to Anamanda Rake, and this knowledge alone was sufficient, for it burned like acid, it stung like shame. They wore their masks, and as they fought, the painted slashes, the sigils of rank, began to fade, worn away by the fires of chaos, until upon each warrior the mask gleamed pure. As if here, within the world of this sword, some power could yield to greater truths. Here, Dragneepur seemed to say, you are all equal. The grey sword's other flank closed up with another knot of soldiers, the bridge-burners, into which remnants of other Malazan forces were falling, drawing upon the elite company's ascendant power, and upon the commander now known as Iskar Jarak. The bridge-burners were arrayed in a half-circle that slowly contracted under the brunt of the assault, grey swords on one flank and the last of the chained on the other, where a huge demon formed the point of a defiant wedge that refused to buckle. Tears streamed down the demon's face, for even as it fought, it grieved for those lost. And such grief filled Pearl's heart unto bursting. Pearl did not fight for itself, nor for the wagon, nor even the gate of darkness, the wandering hold. The demon fought for its comrades, as would a soldier pushed beyond breaking, pushed until there was nowhere else to go. In the ash-swarmed sky above, chained dragons, Loki, Weaval, and Enkarala tore swaths through the tumbling, descending storm clouds. Lightning lashed out to enwreath them, slowly tearing them to pieces. Still they fought on. The Enkarala would not relent, for they were mindless in their rage. The Loki Weaval found strength in hearts greater than their modest proportions. No, they were not dragons, they were lesser kin. But they knew the power of mockery, of disdain. For the Enkarala, chaos itself was a contemptible thing. The dragons, many of whom had been chained since the time of Draconis, were indifferent to the gate, to all the other squalid victims of this dread sword. They did not fight on behalf of any noble cause. No, each one fought alone, for itself, and they knew that survival had nothing to do with nobility. No alliance was weighed, no thought of fighting in concert brushed the incandescent minds of these creatures. Nothing in their nature was designed to accommodate aught but singular battle. A strength and a curse, but in these fiery, deadly clouds, that strength was failing, and the very nature of the dragons was now destroying them. The battle raged. Annihilation was a deafening scream that drove all else from the minds of the defenders. They made their will into weapons, and with these weapons they slashed through the misshapen, argent foe, only to find yet more rising before them, howling, laughing, swords thundering on shields. Tok had no idea where this damned horse had come from, but clearly some breathtaking will fired its soul. In its life it had not been bred for war, and yet it fought like a beast twice its weight, kicking, stamping, jaws snapping. A Wiccan breed, he was fairly certain of that, a creature of appalling endurance, it carried him into the fray again and again, and he had begun to suspect that he would fail before the horse did. Humbling, No, infuriating. He struggled to control it as he sought to lunge once more into that wall of chaotic rage. Getting to be a miserable habit, all this dying and dying again. Of course, this would be the final time, and a better man than he would find some consolation in that. A better man, aye. Instead, he railed, he spat into the eye of injustice, and he fought on, even as his one eyeless socket itched damnably, until it seemed to be sizzling as if eating its way into his brain. He lost his grip on the reins, and almost pitched from the saddle as the horse galloped away from the front line of the bridge burners. He loosed a stream of curses. He wanted to die at their sides. He needed to. No, he was not one of them. He could not match their power, their ascendant ferocity. He had seen Trotz there and Detteran, and so many others, and there was Iskar Jarak himself, although why Whiskey Jack had come to prefer some Seven Cities name in place of his real one made no sense to Tok. Not that he was of any stature to actually ask the man. Gods, even had he been, he couldn't have got close, so tightly were the bridge burners arrayed around the soldier. And now the stupid horse was taking him farther and farther away. He saw ahead the Lord of Death, standing motionless as if contemplating guests at a damned picnic. The horse carried Tok straight for the hoary bastard, who slowly turned at the very last moment as the horse skidded to a halt in a spray of ashes and mud. Hood glanced down at the spatter on its frayed robes.
"Don't look at me," Tok snarled as he collected up the reins once more. "I was trying to get the beast going the other way."
"You are my herald, Tok the Younger, and I have need of you."
"To do what? Announce your impending nuptials? Where is the skeletal hag, anyway?"
"You have a message to deliver."
"Deliver where? How? In case you haven't noticed, we're in a little trouble here, Hood. God's my eye. Ah, I mean, the missing one. It's driving me mad."
"Yes, your missing eye. About that."
At that instant, Tok's horse reared in sudden terror as a churning cloud lunged down like an enormous fist, engulfing a dying dragon directly overhead. Swearing, his voice rising in fear, Tok fought to regain control of the beast as cloud and dragon tumbled to one side. The dragon pulled down to the thrashing legions, which closed in and swarmed it. In moments, the dragon was gone. The horse skittered and then settled, only to bolt once more, as in a burst of cold, bitter air, something else arrived. What good could ever come of acceding to the suggestions of a corpse? This was the sort of question Glano Tarp was good at asking. Only he'd forgotten this time, and it was funny how blind, gibbering terror could do that. Warrens and warrens and portals and gates and places nobody in their right minds might want to visit, no matter how special the scenery. And no, damn it, he didn't know where they'd just ended up. But he could tell, oh yes, he could tell all right, that it wasn't a nice place. Horses shrilling, but then they always did that when arriving, carriage slapping down onto gritty mud in a chorus of outraged creaks, splinters, and calamcophony, slewing this way and that, and the sky was coming down in giant balls of mercury, and there were dragons up there, and Wival, and Hood knew what else. Chains sawing back and forth, to the sides and straight up, all emerging from the ghastliest wagon Glano had ever seen, loaded with more bodies than seemed reasonable, much less possible. So, of course, he froze up all the brakes. What else was he supposed to do? And then bodies were flying past. Sweetest sufferance curled up into a soft, flouncy, bouncy ball that landed bouncily and rolled and rolled. That snarling hulk Gruntle, twisting in the air so that he could land on all fours, meow, and faint, far less elegant for all her bountiferous beauty, going splat on her face, all spread-eagled, silly girl. Ambi and Jula flew past, embraced like lovers, at least until the grounds showed up and got between them. Recanto Ilk fetched up beside Lano, cracking the backrest of the bench.
"You idiot! We ain't tied ourselves! It was just dark and dark and nothing else, and now you just go and drop us into—"
"Wasn't me, you clumsy pig!"
This argument didn't survive the fullest comprehension of their surroundings. Recanto Ilk slowly sat up.
Holy shit!
Glano leapt to his feet.
Cartographer!
But he'd forgotten about his splints. Yelping, he tottered, and then pitched forward onto the backs of the first two horses. They deftly stepped to either side so that he could fall a little more before getting tangled in all the crap down there, whereupon the horses eagerly moved back in an effort to crush him into the kind of pulp that could never again whip the reins. Recanto scrabbled to drag him back onto the bench. The splint bindings helped, although Glano did plenty of shrieking in pain. At least he wasn't being crushed. Moments later, he fetched up again on the splintered bench. A wretched, dead-looking Jaggert was walking up to Cartographer, who, lashed to a wheel, had come to rest with his head down, eyeing the Jaggert's muddy boots.
"I had begun to wonder," the Jaggert said, "if you had become lost."
Pushing Recanto aside, Glano worked his way round to witness this fateful meeting. Oh yes, that had to be Hood himself. Why, a damned family reunion abrasion. Cartographer's upside-down smile seemed to send a nearby rider's horse into yet another panic, and the soldier swore impressively as he fought to quell the beast.
"My lord,"
Cartographer was saying,
"we both know, surely, that what goes around comes around."
And then he struggled feebly at his bindings.
"And around," he added despondently.
Gruntle, who had staggered up to join them, now growled deep in his chest and then went to the carriage door, thumping it with a fist.
"Master Quill!"
Hood turned to the warrior.
"That will not be necessary, Treach Spawn. My sole requirement was that you arrive here. Now you need only leave once more. Cartographer will guide you."
Sweetest Sufferance was dragging a dazed faint back up onto the carriage, displaying surprising strength, although the effort made her eyes bulge alarmingly. Glano nudged Recanto and nodded towards Sweetest.
"That face remind you of anything?"
Recanto squinted and then sniggered.
"You're both dead,"
she hissed. Ambi and Jula bobbed into view to either side of her, grinning through smears of mud. Inside the carriage, Mappo started to open the door, but Quell snapped out a shaky hand to stay him.
"Gods, don't do that!"
Precious Thimble had curled up on the floor at their feet, rocking and moaning.
"What awaits us outside?"
the Trell asked. Quell shook his head. He was bone white, face glistening with sweat.
"I should have guessed. The way that map on the road narrowed at the far end. Oh, we've been used, duped. Gods, I think I'm going to be sick."
"Damned Trigal,"
muttered Tok, more confused than he had ever been by this sudden inexplicable arrival. How did they manage to arrive here? And then he saw Gruntle.
"Gods below, it's you!"
Someone was being loudly sick inside the carriage. Gruntle stared up at Tok and then frowned.
"Oh, I guess I don't look like Annister anymore. We shared..."
"Herald," said Hood. "It is time."
Tok scowled and then scratched at his eye socket.
"What? You're sending me with them?"
"In a manner of speaking."
"Then I'm to rejoin the living?"
"Alas, no, Tok the Younger. You are dead, and dead you will remain. But this shall mark your final task as my herald. Another god claims you."
Tok prepared to dismount, but the Lord of Death lifted a hand.
"Ride in the carriage's wake, close in its wake, for a time. Now, herald, listen well to my last message. The blood is needed. The blood is needed."
Gruntle had stopped listening. Even the vague disquiet he'd felt when that one-eyed rider had accosted him was fast vanishing beneath a flood of battle lust. He stared out at the enemy, watched the defenders wither away. A war that could not be won by such sorry souls. A war that begged for a champion, one who would stand until the very end. Another growl rumbled from him, and he stepped away from the carriage, reaching for his cutlasses.
"Whoa there, ye damned Manx!"
The bark startled him, and he glared up at Dlan O'Tarp, who smiled a hard smile.
"Shareholders can't just walk away. We'd have to plug you full of arrows. Get back aboard, Stripey. We're leaving all over again."
There could be but one outcome, and Draconis had known that all along. He had sensed nothing of the Trigal's arrival, nor even its departure, with Tok riding in its wake. Whatever occurred behind him could not reach through to awaken his senses. One outcome. After all, Dragnipur had never offered salvation. Iron forged to bind, 100,000 chains hammered into the blade, layers upon layers entwined, folded, wrapped like rope. Draconis, surrounded in the molten fires of Burn's heart, drawing forth chains of every metal that existed, drawing them out link by glowing link. Twisted ropes of metal on the anvil, and down came the hammer. The one hammer, the only tool that could forge such a weapon. And he remembered its vast weight, the scalding grip that lacerated his alien hand. Even in her dreaming, Burn had been most displeased. Chains upon chains, chains to bind. Bind darkness itself, transforming the ancient forest through which it had wandered, twisting that black wood into a wagon, into huge tottering wheels, into a bed that formed a horizontal door, like the entrance to a barrow above the portal. Blackwood, to hold and contain the soul of Kurald Galain. He remembered. Sparks in countless hues skipping away like shattered rainbows. The deafening ringing of the hammer and the way the anvil trembled to every blow. The waves of heat flashing against his face. The bitter taste of raw ore. The stench of sulphur. Chains. Chains and chains pounded down into glowing impressions upon the blade, quenched and honed and into Burn's white heart, and then it begins again and again. Chains, chains to bind, bind the fallen. And now, unbelievably, impossibly, Draconis had felt that first splintering. Chains had broken. So it ends. I did not think, I did not imagine. He had witnessed his bound companions falling away, failing. He had seen the chaos descend upon each one, eating through flesh with actinic zeal, until shackles fell to the ground, until the iron bands held nothing, nothing left. I never meant, I never wanted such an end to any of you, of us. No, I was far too cruel to ever imagine an end, an escape. Yet now, witness these thoughts of mine. Now I would see you all live on, yes, in these chains, but not out of cruelty. Ah, no, not that. Abyss, take me, I would see you live out of mercy. Perhaps he wept now, or these scalding tears announced the crushing end of hysterical laughter. No matter, they were all being eaten alive. We are all being eaten alive. And Dragnipur had begun to come apart. When the chaos disintegrated the wagon, destroyed the door and took hold of the gate, the sword would shatter and chaos would be freed of this oh-so-clever trap, and Draconis's brilliant lure, his eternal snare, eternally leading chaos on and away from everything else, would have failed. He could not contemplate what would happen then to the countless succession of realms and worlds, and of course he would not be there to witness the aftermath in any case. But he knew that, in his last thoughts, he would feel nothing but unbearable guilt. So, chaos, at least unto one victim, what you deliver is indeed mercy. He had begun walking forward to join the other bound, to stand perhaps at Pearl's side until the end came. The echo of that snapping chain haunted him. Someone's broken loose. How? Even the Hounds of Shadow could only slip free by plunging into Kurald Galain's black heart. Their chains did not break. Dragnipur's essential integrity had not been damaged. But now, someone's broken loose. How? chains and chains and chains to bind. A bony hand closed on his shoulder and dragged him back. Snarling, Draconis half turned.
Let go, damn you! I will stand with them, Hood! I must! Can't you see that?
The Lord of Death's hand tightened, the nails biting, and Hood slowly pulled him closer.
The fray, the god said in a rasp, is not for you.
You are not my master. Stand with me, Draconis. It's not yet time.
For what? He struggled to tear free, but a Jaggot's strength could be immense, and barring the bloody removal of his entire shoulder, Draconis could do nothing. He and the Lord of Death stood alone, not 20 paces from the motionless wagon.
Consider this, said Hood, a request for forgiveness.
Draconis stared. What? Who asks my forgiveness? Hood, Lord of the Dead, should have been the last to fall to Dragnipur. Whatever the Son of Darkness intended, its final play was found in the slaying of this ancient god. Such was the conviction of Draconis. A mad, pointless gamble, the empty purchase of time already consumed, the wasting of countless souls, an entire realm of the dead. As it turned out, Draconis was wrong. There was one more, one more. Arriving with the power of a mountain torn apart in a long, deafening, crushing detonation, argent clouds were shredded, whipped away in dark winds. The legions pressing on all sides recoiled, and the thousand closing paces so viciously won were lost in an instant. Dragons screamed, voices erupted as if dragged out from throats, the pressure, the pain, the stunning power. Chaos flinched and then slowly began to gather itself once more. No single force could defeat this enemy. Destruction was its own law, and even as it devoured itself, it would devour everything else. Chaos, riding the road of darkness, ever to arrive unseen, from sources unexpected, from places where one never thought to look, much less guard against. The sword and all within it was dying now, at last, dying. Hood's hand had left his shoulder, and Draconis sagged down onto his knees. One more. And yes, he knew who was now among them. Should he laugh? Should he seek him out, mock him? Should he close hands about his throat so that they could lock one to the other until the descent of oblivion? No, he would do none of this. Who asks for my forgiveness? Had he the strength, he would have cried out. An Amanda Rake, you need not ask. That begging, alas, must come from me. This was Mother Dark I snared here, your mother. And so, what will you now do? A heartbeat later, a faint gasp escaped Draconis, and he lifted his head, opened his eyes once more. Rake, he whispered. Draconis slowly rose and turned to face the wagon. To witness. The second watched yet another Segula fall. He then dragged his horse round to glare with dead eyes at a tall, ornate carriage as its train of screaming horses lunged forward. Figures pitched to one side, holding on for dear life as a fissure tore open, into which those horses vanished. Hood's herald, that one-eyed soldier, drove heels to his tattered mount, following. And the Lord of Death's voice drifted through the second.
It seems you are needed after all, as you suspected. Now go, and know this, old friend, you have served me well. I am the god of death no longer. When you have done this last thing, your service is at an end. And then, well, Skinner awaits.
The second tilted back his masked, helmed head and howled in glee. Sheathing his swords, he rode hard after the carriage. He saw the herald vanish, and the fissure began to close. The second drove his long-dead Jaggot stallion into that dying portal and left the realm of Dragnipur. The other Segula were doomed anyway, and though in this last battle they had each redeemed something of their shame in dying to a foreigner, That was no reason to fall at their sides. The second did not stay long in the wake of the others as they thundered through unknown warrens. No, not long at all. For he had been summoned. Summoned, yes, by a weapon in need. Riding a seething storm of fiery winds, plunging through, his horse's sheaves of armour clattering, its hoofs ringing sharp on cobbles, the second saw what he sought, and he swept his hand down.
"I'll take that," laughed a hollow, metallic voice,
and the lance was torn from Cutter's hand. In an array of flapping tatters of hide, frayed straps and mangled buckles, the undead Segula, who had, long ago, once given him the weapon, now readied the lance, even as the masked warrior charged straight towards the white hounds.
"Skinner!" he roared. "I'm coming for you, but first, these guys."
Carsa Orlong sidestepped at the sudden arrival of some armored warrior riding a monstrous dead horse. Seeing the newcomer ride to meet the hounds, he snarled and set off after him. The lance angled down on the left side, and so the Toblachai went to the rider's right, eyes fixing on a hound that clearly intended an attack on the horseman's unprotected side. Two beasts and two warriors all met at once. The rider's lance drove into a hound's throat just beneath the jaw, surging upward through the base of the skull, severing the spinal cord on its way to obliterate the back of the animal's brain. The serrated lance head erupted from the skull in an explosion of grey pulp, blood and bone shards. Carsa swung down, two-handed, as the other hound arrived alongside the rider and reared to close jaws on the stranger's right thigh. Flint blades sliced down through the spine, chopping halfway through a neck thick as a horse's, before jamming. The hound's forward momentum, now pitching downward, dragged the weapon and Carsa with it as the animal slammed the cobbles. At that instant, the rider's jaggered horse collided chest to chest with a third hound. Bones shattered. The impact sent the rider over his horse's head, dragging his lance free as he went. He struck and rolled off the back of the hound, which seemed stunned as the undead horse stumbled back. Pulled down onto his knees, Carsa ducked the snapping attack of another hound, and then the beast was past, as were all the others. The Toblachai rose, took two quick strides and thrust his sword into the chest of the dazed third hound. Howling in pain, it staggered away from Carsa's blade, blood fountaining out in the path of the withdrawing sword. The stranger had recovered, and he now sank the lance into the gut of the writhing animal, the lance head tearing messily through soft tissue, fluid spilling down. Something flashed in the eye holes of the twin-scarred mask.
"Well done, Toblachai! Now let's chase down the others!"
The two warriors swung round. Cutter stared as seven hounds swept round Carsa and the Segula. Now he didn't even hold a lance, damn it! And he unsheathed a pair of knives as one of the beasts made straight for him. A hand grasped the back of his shirt and yanked him back. Yelling in alarm, Cutter stumbled into someone's short, brawny arms. He caught a momentary glimpse of a weathered face, eyes bulging, red moustache twitching beneath a bulbous nose. "Do I know this man?" And the one who had thrown him clear now lumbered forward, lifting an enormous two-handed axe, Barathol.
"Wrong place for us," growled the man holding Cutter,
and they began backing up. Barathol recognized this beast, the one Char had tangled with, the one that had broken his friend's skull. He almost sang his joy as he launched himself into its path, axe sweeping in a savage diagonal arc, low to high, as the hound arrived, snarling, monstrous. The axe edge bit deep into the beast's lower jaw. Another single instant's delay, and he would have caught its neck. As it was, the blow hammered the hound's head to one side. The beast's chest struck Barathol. As if he'd been standing in the path of a bronze-sheathed battering ram, he was flung back, cartwheeling through the air, and was unconscious before he landed, 15 paces behind the body of Anamanda Rake. The hound had skidded, stumbled, wagging its head, Its right mandible was broken, a row of jagged molars jutting out almost horizontal, blood splashing down. For this battle, the beast was finished. In the moment that Kasa and the stranger whirled round, a shadow swept over them, and both flinched down in the midst of a sudden wind, reeking of rot, gusting past. Tips of its wings clattering along the facings of buildings to either side, a dragon sailed above the street, talons striking like vipers, each one closing round a hound in a crushing, puncturing embrace, lifting the screaming animals into the air. The dragon's head snapped down, jaws engulfing another. And then the dragon thundered its wings and lifted skyward once more, carrying away three hounds. The creature's attack had lasted but a handful of heartbeats, in the moment that Cutter was dragged back into Ansi's arms, the Falari half carrying him in his charge towards the door of the shopfront to the right, and Barathol, his gaze fixed solely upon the hated hound attacking him, swung his axe. These three did not even see the dragon. Samardev stared wide-eyed at the dragon as it heaved back into the sky with its three howling, snarling victims. She was crouched over the motionless form of Traveller, Dasem Ultor, wielder of vengeance, slayer of the Son of Darkness, who now lifted a sorrow-racked visage, bleak, broken, and then reached out and grasped her, tugged her close.
"Not my choice! Do not blame me, woman! Do you hear? Do not!"
Then his eyes widened, and he dragged her down onto the cobbles, covered her with his own body, as two behemoths collided not 3 paces distant. A white hound, and a bear, a god, a beast forgotten in the passing of the world. It had arrived a moment after the hound, and its massive forearms wrapped round in a crushing embrace, lifting the hound into the air, and clear of Samardev and Dasem, before both creatures slammed into and through the building's front wall. Rubble crashed down, tumbling chunks of masonry striking Dasem's broad back as he pulled himself and Samar away from the collapsing facade. Somewhere within that building, bear and hound fought in a frenzy. Leaving now two hounds of light, unopposed, and they reached the corpse of Anamanda Rake. Jaws closed about a thigh and its body was dragged upward. The second beast circled as if contemplating its own bite, but the sword still lodged in the Tistandi's skull was pitching about as the first animal sought to carry away its prize, and wise caution kept it back. The Segula threw his lance from 15 paces away. The weapon sank into the side of the circling hound, knocking it down, to be up again in an instant, snarling and snapping at the jutting shaft. Karsa, whose longer strides had sent him ahead of the second, voiced a Teblor battle cry, an ancient one heard only when the elders spun their tales of ancient heroes, and the hound gripping Rake's corpse flinched at the sound. Releasing its hold on that torn, gashed leg, it lunged towards the attacking Toblakai. Two javelins struck the animal from its left. Neither lodged, but it was enough to sting its attention, and the hound's head pitched round to confront the new attackers. Two young Teblor women stood on the other side of the avenue, each calmly readying another javelin in her atlatl. Between them stood a large, mangy dog, tensed, fangs bared, its growl so low it might as well have been coming up from the earth below. The hound hesitated. Karsa charged towards it, blade whistling through the air. The beast broke and ran, and the Toblakai's sword sliced off its stubby tail and nothing else. The hound howled. Shifting round, Karsa advanced on the other animal. It had dragged the lance loose, and now it too was fleeing, leaving a trail of blood. The Segula reclaimed his gore-smeared weapon. Karsa hesitated, and then he moved to stand over the body of Anamanda Rake.
"They are beaten," he said.
The masked face swung round, dead eyes in rimmed slits regarded him.
"It has been a long time since I last heard that war cry, Toblakai. Pray," the warrior added, "I never hear it again."
Karsa's attention, however, was drawn to the Teblor women, and the dog that now advanced, its own stubbed tail wagging. Staring at the animal, watching its limping approach, Carsa Orlong struggled against a sob. He had sent this dog home. Half dead, fevered and weak from blood loss, it had set out so long ago now, so long ago. He looked up at the Teblor girls, neither of whom spoke. It was difficult to see through the tears. Did he know these two? No, they looked too young. They looked... Down the side street, the five hounds of shadow had been driven back, unable to hold their ground against the combined sorceries of spite and envy. The magic slashed their hides, blood sprayed from their snouts, and on all sides forces sought to crush them down, destroy them utterly. Writhing, battered, they fell back, step by step, and the daughters of Draconis drew ever closer to their prize, their father's sword. A birthright long denied them. Of course, both envy and spite understood the value of patience. Patience, yes, in the fruition of their desires, their needs. The hounds could not match them, not in power, nor in savage will. The long wait was almost over. The sisters barely registered the quiet arrival of a carriage well behind the hounds. Alas, the same could not be said for the one who stepped out from it and swung strangely bestial eyes towards them. That steady, deadly regard reached through indeed. They halted their advance. Sorceries died away. The hounds, shedding blood that steamed in the dawn's light, limped back in the direction of the fallen wielder of Dragnipur. Envy and spite hesitated. Desires were stuffed, screaming, back into their tiny lockboxes. Plans hastily, bitterly readjusted. Patience, ah, patience, yes, awakened once more. Oh well, maybe next time. The vicious battle within the shell of the mostly demolished building had ended. Heart fluttering with fear, Samardev cautiously approached. She worked her way over the rubble and splintered crossbeams, edged past an inner wall that had remained mostly intact, and looked then upon the two motionless leviathans. A faint cry rose from her. Awkwardly, she made her way closer, and a moment later found herself half sitting, half slumped against a fragmented slab of plastered wall, staring down at the dying bear's torn and shredded head. The hound was gasping as well, its back end buried beneath the giant bear, red foam bubbling from its nostrils, each breath shallower and wetter than the one before, until finally, with a single, barely audible sigh, it died. Samardev's attention returned to the god that had so haunted her, ever looming, ever testing the air, seeking what?
What?
She asked it now in a hoarse whisper.
What did you want?
The beast's one remaining eye seemed to shift slightly inside its ring of red. In it, she saw only pain and loss. The witch drew out her knife. Was this the thing to do? Should she not simply let it go? Let it leave this unjust, heartless existence? The last of its kind, forgotten by all.
Well, I will not forget you, my friend.
She reached down with the knife and slipped the blade into the pool of blood beneath the bear's head. And she whispered words of binding, repeating them over and over again until at last the light of life departed the god's eye. Clutching two hounds with a third one writhing in his mouth, Tulas Shorn could do little more than shake the beasts half senseless as the dragon climbed ever higher above the mountains north of Lake Azure. Of course, he could do one more thing. He could drop them from a great height, which he did, with immense satisfaction.
Wait! Wait! Stop it! Stop!
Iskarel Past climbed free of the ruckus, the mound of thrashing, snarling, spitting and grunting Bokarala, the mass of tangled torn hair and filthy robes and prickly toes that was his wife, and he glared round.
You idiots! He isn't even here anymore! Gah! It's too late. Gah! That odious, slimy, putrid lump of red-vested dung! No! Get that away from me, ape!
He leapt to his feet. His mule stood alone.
What good are you?
He accused the beast, raising a fist. Morgora climbed upright, adjusting her clothes. She then stuck out her tongue, which seemed to be made entirely of spiders. Seeing this, Iskaralpas gagged.
Gods, no wonder you can do what you do,
she cackled.
And oh, how you beg for more! Ah, if I'd known, I'd have begged for something else. Oh, what would you have begged for, sweetie? A knife, so I could cut my own throat. Look at me, I'm covered in bites. They got sharp teeth, all right, them Bokarala. Not them, month-old cream puff. These are spider bites. You deserve even worse. Did you drug her senseless? There's no other way she'd agree to... Power! I have power. It's irresistible. Everybody knows that. A man can look like a slug. His hair can stick out like a Bedouin's tongue. He can be knee-high and perfectly proportioned. He can stink. He can eat his own earwax. None of it matters if he has power. Well, that's what's wrong with the world, then. It's why ugly people don't just die out.
And then she smiled.
It's why you and me were made for each other. Let's have babies, hundreds of babies.
Iskaralpas ran to his mule, scrabbled aboard, and fled for his life. The mule walked, seemingly unmindful of the rider thrashing and kicking about on its back, and at a leisurely saunter, Mogora kept pace. The Bokarala, which had been cooing and grooming in a reconciliatory love fest, now flapped up into the air, circling over their god's head like gnats round the sweetest heap of dung ever beheld. Approaching thunder startled Pica from her reverie within the strange cave, and she stared upon the carved rock wall, eyes widening to see the image of the carriage blurring as if in motion. If the monstrosity was indeed pounding straight for her, moments from exploding into the cavern, then she would be trampled, for there was nowhere to go in the hope of evading those rearing horses and the pitching carriage behind them. An absurd way for her soul to die. The apparition arrived in a storm of infernal wind, yet it emerged from the wall ghostly, almost transparent, and she felt the beasts and the conveyance tear through her. A momentary glimpse of a manic driver, eyes wide and staring, both legs jutting out straight and splayed and apparently splinted. And still others, on the carriage roof and tossing about on the ends of straps from the sides, expressions stunned and jolted. All of this sweeping through her and past. And a rider lunged into view directly before her, sawing the reins. And this man and his mount were real, solid. Sparks spat out from skidding hoofs, the horse's eyeless head lifting. Pica staggered back in alarm. Damned corpses! She stared up at the rider and then swore.
I know you!
The one-eyed man, enwreathed in the stench of death, settled his horse and looked down upon her, and then he said,
I am Hood's herald now, Corporal Picker.
Oh, is that a promotion?
No, a damned sentence. And you're not the only one I need to visit, so enough of the sardonic shit and listen to me.
She bridled.
Why? What am I doing here? What's Hood want with me that he ain't already got? Hey, take a message back to him. I want to...
I cannot, Picker. Hood is dead.
He's what?
The Lord of Death no longer exists. Gone. Forevermore. Listen, I ride to the gods of war. Do you understand, Talkbearer? I ride to all the gods of war.
Talkbearer? She sagged.
Ah, shit.
Tok the Younger spoke then and told her all she needed to know. When he was done, she stared, the blood drained from her face, and watched as he gathered the reins once more and prepared to leave.
Wait, she demanded. I need to get out of here. How do I do that, Tok?
The dead eye fixed upon her one last time. He pointed at the gourds resting on the stone floor to either side of Picker.
Drink. Live up to your name. Pick one, Picker.
Are you mad? You just told me where that blood's come from.
Drink, and remember all that I have told you.
And then he was gone. Remember, yes, she would do that.
Find the Toblakai, find the killer, and remind him. Remind him, do you understand me? Then, Talkbearer, lead him to war. Lead him to war.
There had been more, much more. none of it anything she could hope to forget.
All I wanted to do was retire.
Cursing under her breath, she walked over to the nearest gourd, crouched down before it.
Drink. It's blood, damn it. Drink.
To stand in the heart of Dragnipur, to stand above the very gate of darkness, this was, for Anamanda Rake, a most final act. Perhaps it was desperation, or a sacrifice beyond all mortal measure. A weapon named vengeance, or a weapon named grief. Either way, where he had been delivered by that sword was a world of his own making, and all the choices that might have been were as dust on the bleak trail of his life. He was the son of darkness. His people were lost. There was, for him, room to grieve, here at the end of things, and he could finally turn away, as his mother had done so long ago. Turn away from his children, as every father must one day do, in that final moment that was death. The notion of forgiveness did not even occur to him, as he stood on the mound of moaning, tattooed bodies. He was, after all, not the begging sort. The one exception was Draconis. Ah, but those circumstances were unique, the crime so faceted, so intricately complicated, that it did no good to seek to prise loose any single detail. In any case, the forgiveness he asked for did not demand an answer. All that mattered was that Draconis be given those words. He could do with them as he pleased. Anamanda Rake stood, eyes fixed heavenward, facing that seething conflagration, the descending annihilation, and he did not blink, did not flinch. For he felt its answer deep within him, in the blood of Tiam, the blood of chaos. He would stand, then, for all those he had chained here. He would stand for all the others as well. And for these poor broken souls underfoot, he would stand and face that ferocious chaos. Until the very last moment, the very last moment. Like a mass of serpents, the tattoos swarmed beneath him. Kataspala had waited for so long, for this one chance. Vengeance against the slayer of a beloved sister, the betrayer of Andarist, noble Andarist, husband and brother. Oh, he had come to suspect what Anamanda Rake intended. Sufficient reparation? All but one Tist Andi would answer yes to that question. All but one.
Not Kataspala. No, not me. Not me, not me. Not me, not me, not me. I will make you fail. In this, your last gesture, your pathetic attempt at reconciliation, I will make you fail. See this god I made? See it? See it? See it? No. You did not expect that, expect that, expect that. Did you now? Did you now?
Nor the knife in its hand. Nor the knife in its hand. Teeth bared, blind Kataspala twisted onto his back, the better to see the son of darkness, yes, the better to see him. Eyes were not necessary, and eyes were not necessary to see the bastard. Standing so tall, so fierce, almost within reach. Atop the mountain of bodies, the moaning bridge of flesh and bone, the sordid barrier at Dark's door, this living ward, so stupid, standing there, eyes lifting up, soul facing down and down and downward. Will she sense him? Will she turn? Will she see? Will she understand? No to all of these things. For Kataspala has made a god, a god, a god. He has made a god, and the knife, the knife, the knife. Anamanda Rake stands, and the map awakens, its power and his power awakening. Wandering hold, wander no longer, fleeing gate, flee no more. This is what he will do. This is the sacrifice he will make. Oh, so worthy, so noble, yes, and clever, and so very clever. And who else but Anamanda Rake, so noble and so clever?
All to fail. Child God, it's time. Feel the knife in your hand. Feel it. Now lift it high. The fool sees nothing, suspects nothing, knows nothing of how I feel, how I do not forget, will never forget, will never forget, and no, I will never forget. Reach high. Stab, stab, stab!
storm of light, a scattered moon, a rising sun behind bruised clouds from which brown, foul rain poured down. Black Coral was a city under siege, and the Tist-Andi within it could now at last feel the death of their lord, and with him the death of their world. Was it fair to settle the burden of long-dead hope upon one person, to ask of that person so much? Was it not, in fact, cowardice? He had been their strength, he had been their courage, and he had paid the hound's toll for them all, centuries upon centuries, and not once had he turned away, as if to stand in his mother's stead, as if to do what she would not. Our lord is dead, he has left us. A people grieved. The rain descended. Kellick ran in bitter streams on the streets down building walls, filled the gutters in mad rush, droplets struck and sizzled black upon the hide of Silana. This was the reign of usurpation, and against it they felt helpless. Drink deep, Black Coral, and dance, yes, dance until you die. Monk Rat struggled his way up the muddy, root-tangled slope with the last two children in his arms. He glanced up to see Spindle crouched at the crest, smeared in clay, looking like a damned gargoyle. But there was no glee in the staring eyes, only exhaustion and dread. The unnatural rain had reached out to this broken, half-shattered forest. The old trenches and berms were black with slime, the wreckage of retaining walls reminding him of rotting bones and teeth, as if the hillside's flesh had been torn away to reveal a giant, ravaged face, which now grinned vacuously at the grey and brown sky. The two ex-bridge burners had managed to find an even 20 children, four of them so close to death they'd weighed virtually nothing, hanging limp in their arms. The two men had worked through the entire night ferrying them up to the entrenchments, down into the tunnels where they could be out of the worst of the rain. They had scrounged blankets, some food, clean water in clay jugs. As Monk Rat drew closer, Spindle reached down to help him scrabble over the edge. The scrawny girls dangled like straw dolls, heads lolling, as Monk Rat passed each one up to Spindle, who stumbled away with them, sloshing through the muddy rivulet of the trench. Monk Rat sagged, stared down at the ground to keep the rain from his eyes and mouth as he drew in deep breaths. A lifetime of soldiering, aye, the kind that made miserable slogs like this one old news, as familiar as a pair of leaking leather boots. So what made this one feel so different? He could hear someone crying in the tunnel, and then Spindle's voice, soothing, reassuring. And gods, how Monk Rat wanted to weep. Different, aye, so very different. Soldiers, he muttered, come in all sorts. He'd been one kind for a long time, and had grown so sick of it he'd just walked away. And now Spindle showed up to take him and drag him inside out and make him into a different kind of soldier. And this one, why, it felt right. It felt proper. He'd no idea. He looked over as Spindle stumbled into view.
Let's leave it at this, Spin, he begged. Please. I want to stick a knife in Gradithan's face, Spindle growled. I want to cut out his black tongue. I want to drag the bastard up here so every one of them tykes can see what I do to him. You do that and I'll kill you myself, Monk Rat vowed, baring his teeth. They've seen too much as it is, Spin. They get to see vengeance. It won't feel like vengeance to them, Monk Rat said. It'll just be more of the same fucking horror, the same cruel madness. You want vengeance? Do it in private, Spindle. Do it down there. But don't expect my help. I won't have none of it. Spindle stared at him. That's a different row of knots you're showing me here, Monk Rat. Last night, you was talking it up about how we'd run him down and do him good. I changed my mind, Spin. These poor runts did that.
He hesitated.
You did that, making me do what we'd just done.
He then laughed harshly.
Fancy this, I'm feeling redeemed. Now ain't that ironic, Spin?
Spindle slowly settled back against the trench wall and then sank down until he was sitting in the mud.
Shit. How about that?
and I walked all this way, looking for just what you done and found here. I was needing something. I thought they was answers, but I didn't even know the right questions.
He grimaced and spat.
I still don't.
Monkrat shrugged.
Me neither. But you've been redeemed.
And that statement was almost bitter-sounding. Monkrat struggled with his thoughts.
When that hits you, me, when it hit me, well, what it's feeling like right now, Spin, it's like redemption finds a new meaning. It's when you don't need answers no more, because you know that anybody promising answers is full of crap. Priest, priestess, god, goddess, full of crap. You understanding me? That don't sound right, Spindle objected. To be redeemed, someone's got to do the redeeming. But maybe it don't have to be someone else. Maybe it's just doing something, being something, someone, and feeling that change inside. It's like you went and redeemed yourself, and nobody else's opinion matters. And you know that you've still got all them questions, right ones, wrong ones, and maybe you'll be able to find an answer or two, maybe not. But it don't matter. The only thing that matters is you now know ain't nobody else has got a damn thing to do with it, with any of it. That's the redemption I'm talking about here.
Spindle leaned his head back and closed his eyes.
Lucky you, Monkrat. No, I mean that. I do. You idiot. I was rotting here, seeing everything and doing nothing. If I now ended up someplace else, it's all because of you. Shit, you just done what a real priest should do. No fucking advice, no bullshit wisdom, no sympathy, none of that crap. Just a damned kick in the balls and get on with doing what you know is right. Anyway, I won't forget what you done, Spin. I won't ever forget.
Spindle opened his eyes, and Monkrat saw an odd frown on the man's face as he stared skyward. And then he too looked up.